Yeah, so welcome to Sangonite. Great to see so many of you, and also great to see so many from the weekend retreat that we just had at Lockerbrook. There's loads of faces from that retreat, so good to see you all again. So this evening's talk is called Special Practices, and we're exploring the seven-point mind training tradition. We've had this theme of mind training, the alchemy of the emotions. And we've been looking at training our mind, training our hearts and mind in the hearts and mind of a bodhisattva. And if you're lucky enough to be here last week, you'll have heard a really beautiful evocation by Padma Vajra of what it, trying to imagine what it might be like to have that mind and that heart of a bodhisattva. I really recommend listening to that talk if you weren't here, but just some of the things that I can remember from that talk. He talked about just imagining wanting to remove every ache from every living being so that no living being is suffering. That's the volition of a bodhisattva. And just really evoking, seeing every human being as the same, having the same emotions as us, cherishing themselves the same as us, and having the same potential for enlightenment. So just, he really beautifully last week evoked that state of the bodhisattva. So we've already seen, we've been going through exploring the text of the seven-point mind training. There we go. So, and one of the key verses we've seen, we've been exploring, is that we can turn adverse conditions, we can transform adverse conditions into the path of enlightenment. And we've heard about ways of transforming adverse conditions through compassion, where we can see them as opportunities to strengthen our connection and empathy with other living beings. And we've heard about using adverse conditions as an opportunity to cultivate wisdom by seeing through our stories about reality and about the nature of things. But there's a third way that the text tells us that we can transform adversity, and that is by using special practices. So mind training gives us ways of practicing among the kind of the adversity, the rough and tumble of everyday life, the complexity of everyday life. And it gives us ways of dealing with some of the problems that this kind of life, our kind of life, is bound to create. And ways to benefit from the kind of life that we lead. We lead kind of complex modern lives. But that gives us plenty of opportunities. We are faced with lots of adversity every day. So our lifestyle, mind training, gives us an opportunity that we can really practice with these modern lifestyles. So I will tell you what the special practices are in a moment, but I've been relating to them as like superhero powers. I've been, because my son is into superheroes at the moment, and he recently asked me, well, when I grow up, what superpowers will I have? And I think he was interested in flying. He'd like to have flying as a superpower. And there was another one, I can't remember what it was. But so I was thinking, well, maybe if a bodhisattva was a superhero, then these practices, these special practices, are, you could see as like ways of cultivating superhero powers, bodhisattva superhero powers. So the special practices are a list called the four practices. And the verse that refers to them in the mind training tradition says, the four practices are the best method. And that's all it says in typical mind training style. It doesn't say anything about what the four practices are. But the commentaries unpack a bit about what these four practices are. And some of them might seem a bit odd or a bit alien to our way of thinking things, so they need a bit of translating. But hopefully you'll see they are very relevant to us. So the first of these four practices, four ways of turning adversity into an opportunity to practice, is making merit. So you may or may not have come across this idea, a very traditional idea of merit in Buddhism. Punya is the word, punya. And it's a very important idea in traditional Buddhism. Traditionally, merit is seen as a sort of spiritual wealth, a richness that we can accumulate, that we can build up through skillful positive action. And it makes us more substantial people. Merit makes us a kind of bigger person with a more spiritual presence and power. But actually, it's just a different way of thinking about and talking about the effect on us of karma, of when we act skillfully. It's just an extension of the law of karma. So our actions of body and speech and mind create the kind of person we're going to become in the future. And if we act skillfully, if we act altruistically, nobly, we become larger, stronger beings. We become more noble beings with inner riches, inner abundance, and a bigger spiritual presence. And this way of thinking about karma and skillful practices in terms of making merit, it does. I find it helpful because it names, it acknowledges something which I experience, which otherwise doesn't really get acknowledged. And that is that when you do live a skillful life, when you practice skillfully and cultivate skillful karma, it does seem like you build a momentum of positivity, a momentum of riches almost, you can feel that slip away when you're unskillful as well. But when you build up this merit, this kind of, sometimes it's described as a field of merit, and it does seem like the world responds to you differently as well. People respond differently. The world seems to respond differently. So I do like this way of talking about making merit. And when we live active, engaged lives in the world, where there's plenty of opportunities to make merits, this is a way we can really work in. And we can see it as spiritual bodybuilding. We're kind of building a bigger presence, more ethical, more skillful, ethical being. Traditionally, when you see images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they have these two auras. They have an aura around their head, which represents the effect of their wisdom, the kind of field of their wisdom. But there's also a larger, much larger aura around their body, which represents their merit, the field of their accumulated merit. And, I think the fact that it's so large is significant. It almost seems that it's more substantial. Their merit, their skillful action, the effect on the world is more substantial, perhaps, than their wisdom. So there's an image of Amitabha there, an image of White Tower, of Manjushri, and you can see this kind of the aura of their merit, the field of their merit affecting the world. So there's a list of some ways of making merit. So a very obvious one is practicing the precepts. By practicing the positive precepts, we are accumulating a momentum, a positive momentum, in a very positive direction. So just by living skillfully and practicing the precepts, we are accumulating merit, we're making merit. Also, by practicing generosity specifically and altruistic activity is seen traditionally as being a way of making merit, accumulating merit. Yeah, and then serving something bigger than me is karmically very significant. So the idea of just living a life that's just about ourselves, just about us, is very limited. But when we commit ourselves to serve serve something bigger than me, that is hugely positive from a karmic point of view. You'll be accumulating a lot of merit. And I want to just also talk about meditation as being weighty karma. So often we can think about meditation in terms of an opportunity to have a nice time or to have a pleasant experience or to kind of escape from the world for a little while. But actually, every time we're sitting down to meditate, it's a really important opportunity to transform our minds. That's what meditation is for. We can be cultivating mindfulness and metta, transforming the habits of our mind. And when we're meditating, it's an opportunity when our mind is really flexible, really malleable. So we can really make a dent into these habits. We can really transform our mind. So it's seen as being really, really weighty karma. So if you can build up a daily practice of meditation, this is a really significant way of transforming your mind, of changing your mind karmically. And then fifthly, puja is seen traditionally as being a way of cultivating merit, practicing puja, devotion to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, something transcendent, something sacred. Okay. Go back to my list, just to remind me as well as you. So the second in the list is confession. Confession. Yeah, so if we are living active, engaged lives, busy lives in the world like we are doing, then again and again we're going to be breaking the precepts, we're going to be transgressing the precepts, we're going to be acting in ways that are sometimes unskillful and letting ourselves down, letting other people down. And if we lived in a more secluded life, maybe on our own or constantly on retreat, well, we're not going to be breaking the precepts. And that might sound actually a good thing, that we're not going to be breaking the precepts so often. But according to mind training, when we're in the situation of encountering our unskillful tendencies, our responses, well, that's an opportunity to change. And we can see when we are noticing, when we're breaking the precepts, we're noticing our unskillful drives and tendencies as an opportunity to transform them. Yeah, and we need practices to transform our negative responses. into the responses of a bodhisattva. We need these special practices, and confession is the practice. So you might have come across confession in a puja. It's a specific stage in the puja, the sevenfold puja, where we acknowledge to ourselves and to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas where things that we regret, things where occasions when we've broken the precepts, and we let go of them. But we can, we can formally take a practice of confession, and I'll talk a bit more about that. So when we are unskillful, there might be a couple of tendencies, unhelpful tendencies that get in the way. Maybe we're just in denial of our unskillfulness. We're not really looking at it. We don't really want to be aware of it. So we're not really paying much attention to the occasions when we break the precepts. So we might be unaware. We might be in denial about that. Or sometimes we might be defending our unskillfulness. We might be prone to saying, well, this is just a human response. This is what humans do. Or they deserved it. It was their fault. If we're not really on the ball with our precepts, we can kind of let ourselves off the hook. But confession is a practice where we deliberately and kind of explicitly look out for review our ethical life. We kind of look over our ethical life from the past day, the past week, and then we acknowledge and name the occasions when we've broken the precepts in quite a straightforward way. We do that with our spiritual friends. It allows us to see the unskillful habits we've got into and take responsibility for them. It's really important that we take responsibilities for our own ethical, unskillful responses. Because you might be prone to thinking, well, he made me get angry. But if we're taking responsibility for our reactions, actually, it's more true to say, well, I got angry when this happened. So we've got a choice about how we respond, and we need to own our own reactions. So confession is a way of doing this. We can really take responsibility and own our reactions. So for order members or training for ordination, we're going to have quite usually a formal context where we can take part in confession. So I'm in a chapter, and every Monday afternoon, the other order members in my chapter and myself will start off each chapter meeting by just confessing. We'll start off by just listing, trying to remember occasions when we've broken the precepts that we regret, and just naming them straightforwardly, acknowledging them. And perhaps sometimes making a commitment not to do that again for the coming week or for a specific time. But if you're not training for ordination, you're not an order member, you can still engage in a practice like this. Ideally it would be with somebody that you trust very well. But if you haven't got that kind of relationship, well, maybe some things you could do is just to reflect on your own ethical life. Maybe each day or each week you could reflect on your ethical life more. Try and become more aware of your unskillful responses. You could keep an ethical diary. This is something you could consider, keeping an ethical diary. In my own experience of confession has been really significant, actually. I was brought up in a Catholic Christian tradition, and confession for me was a kind of an experience. It brought up an experience of guilt, really, irrational guilt. I just kind of developed this sense of just being quite a bad person. And it's partly down to my kind of Catholic upbringing, partly due to other conditioning. But I was kind of walking around with this sense that there was something kind of really bad about me, and I had to probably hide that from other people. And then when I was training for ordination, I had the sense, well, if they really find out what I'm like, there's no way that I'll get ordained. There's no way they'll let me into the order. So there's a real tension around wanting to just admit to people and be transparent with people about my own habits, really, my own kind of more grubby habits, you could say. I had the sense, well, there's no way I'd get ordained. But my experience of opening up to people in like a training for ordination retreat or group or in the order, letting people just see me warts and all, I've been able to actually make much deeper connections with people, and people trust me more because they've seen me. They know I've kind of just told them everything about me, and you develop a real trust with other people when you do that. And I wasn't rejected, actually. I was accepted for who I was and trusted even more when I opened up in that way. And there were others who'd lived similar lives to me and made similar mistakes to me, and they could relate to me and what I'd been through. So it was a really liberating experience, really, just to kind of gradually start to let go of that sense of guilt and kind of irrational kind of shame and self-dislike, and just realise, actually, I was a much more ethical person than I realised. And it was okay to share my unethical behaviour with other people. Yeah, so if in my weekly chapter meeting, when I confess what I regret during the previous week, it brings more light. It brings more light. It makes it more explicit, more awareness onto my unskillful tendencies. And it's a very, very powerful context. Yeah, and sometimes I turn up on Mondays and I don't want to share. I don't want to tell them what I've done in the past week. But then I always do, and they always do, and it's a real relief. Actually, it's just a real relief just to be open and transparent with my brothers in the order. Yeah, so when we externalise our habits and confess them this way, they're just seen more fully, and it can be very powerful for me to take, as I say, sometimes take a precept in my chapter and to say, well, I'm not going to do this particular thing for the next week, or yeah. So for me, the first two of these four practices, well, they ought to be very familiar to us. They're kind of very rational ways of working. People who are on the retreat last weekend will kind of be. We're talking about rational and breaking through rational. So maybe the three and four might be kind of less of a less intimidating for you guys. So the first two are very rational ways of working with our bringing awareness to our tendencies, our ethical tendencies, working with the precepts and trying to cultivate positive momentum, cultivating positive karma, and then becoming more aware and naming when we're breaking the precepts. So we're really bringing awareness to our practice of karma and the precepts. But what about these second two? They sound pretty crazy, don't they? Making offerings to obstructive spirits, making offerings to protectors. So what on earth could they be about? Well, if we just return to these first two, it's clear in our Dharma lives we need to make loads of effort in these first two. We need to make loads of effort to transform karmically, using the law of karma to cultivate more and more skillful habits, skillful momentum, punya, merit. And it's really important to become aware and confess and become transparent about our unskillful actions. But sometimes it can seem as though our efforts are being undermined by something that seems out of our control, beyond our control. We can make a commitment and really mean it, like, I'm never going to do that again, or I'm going to meditate every day this week. But somehow it seems our efforts get undermined and we end up not doing what we set out to do. And, you know, this classic kind of New Year resolution, they very, very often get broken. After a few weeks in, it's as though we've just lost interest or we haven't managed to keep up. And we can have a really strong, firm intention behind it, but it seems our efforts just get undermined. Something comes from nowhere and just knocks us sideways. And it can almost seem like we've just gone back to square one, like we haven't made any progress. And this experience is captured mythically in the story from the life of Padmasambhava. And some of you might be familiar with this already, but some of you might not. And this story, the life of Padmasambhava, occurred before Atisha, which we've heard about, all about Atisha taking mind training to Tibet. But Padmasambhava was a forerunner. He was the first person to take the Dharma into Tibet, probably 200 or 300 years before Atisha. And since his time, it kind of become broken down again, and Atisha was needed to re-establish the Dharma. So about the 8th or 9th century, Tibet was a kind of lawless, barbarian land, and the king of Tibet was called King Trisong Detsen, and he'd heard about Buddhism, and he wanted to establish the Dharma in Tibet. So he invited a monk, an abbot monk called Santarakshita, to come to Tibet and build a great monastery at a place called Samye. And he had a great vision that they were going to really make Tibet a place of the Dharma and establish the Dharma in Tibet. And so they made this big commitment, this big plan, and they were really kind of well-intentioned, but it didn't go according to plan. So after the very first day of building, the laborers had worked all day building walls for the monastery. And after a hard day's work, they all went to bed. But when they came back the next morning, all the stones had been returned to the original places. It was as if nothing had happened, as if nothing had changed. No work had been done. Very, very strange. So they built the walls again the next day. And then when they went to bed again, they came back the next day, all the work had been undone, as if nothing had happened. And it turned out that they were being undermined by obstructive spirits and deities. The Nagas of Tibet, the Nagas were obstructing the work of the monastery. So Nagas are mythical beings in Buddhism, often serpents or dragons. And they can be destructive and obstructive, and they can also be protectors of the Dharma, as we'll see. But according to the legends, rather than honouring these spirits and these energies, the abbot and the king had decided to build the monastery on a place where there was a rose bush that was sacred to the Nagas, and they weren't happy about it. So they just decided to obstruct the work and to enlist the genies and the spirits of Tibet to obstruct the work. So King Trisen Detsen and Shantarakshita, the abbot, didn't know what to do. They were completely out of their depth. They couldn't deal with this. They were working in quite a rational way, trying to establish a dharma. This was kind of completely non-rational. They didn't know what to do in these circumstances. But luckily, they'd heard about a guru, a yogi, an enlightened being called Padmasambhava. He was a kind of a magician, shaman, monk, yogi, just a kind of quite a immense Buddhist practitioner. And there's a statue of Padmasambhava that you're seeing over there, and I've got an image of Padmasambhava coming up. There he is. This is a painting from Padmaloka by Arloka of Padmasambhava. So they needed to call to help to a Dharma protector, to a protector, and they called for Padmasambhava to help them. And they realized it wasn't going to work trying to establish the Dharma at a rational level. These were deep, non-rational, subterranean energies at work that were obstructing the work. They needed to meet those energies on their own level. So they called for Padmasambhava, the Dharma protector, to subdue the spirits of Tibet, the obstructive spirits. And what Padmasambhava did, he traveled around Tibet and Nepal, subduing various spirits and genies. And then he arrived at Samye and he entered into negotiation with the Nagas. And he built a new temple for the Nagas and negotiated with them so they would allow the work to continue. So this is this story is connected with these next two on the list, the practice of making offerings to obstructive spirits and making offerings to protectors. So as Western practitioners of the Dharma in our age, this might, I imagine, sound very alien to some of you and a bit weird, a bit odd. But it might also sound a bit weird to know, well, myself and other otherwise rational Western Buddhists have practiced in this way. Sometimes places can seem to have a spirit to them, and sometimes the spirit can either seem kind of benevolent or malevolent, helpful or obstructive. So even otherwise quite rational Western Buddhists sometimes have been known to do rituals that involve making offerings to spirits of places to get them on our side. So I'll give you some examples just to weird you out a bit. So a couple of years ago, myself and my colleagues, it seemed like we were experiencing quite a lot of difficulties. It almost seemed like the centre was under attack almost. It seemed like there was just wave after wave of like difficulties and obstacles and like really difficult situations to respond to. And I do quite enjoy working in this kind of non-rational mythic way. And to me, it just seemed like we needed to invoke the support of the local deities. And I asked my friend Lama Rigzin, who's a Tibetan Lama, to come and perform some rituals to the local deities here. And we did it one Sangha night. Everyone come up for the talk for Sangha night, and me and Lama went outside by the garage and performed puja and made offerings to the local deities. And it was very precise. I needed to bring two different types of chocolate biscuits. So apparently the deities have a sweet tooth. And so it was both kind of very magical and very kind of awkward as well, because we were right by the road and it was chanting away, om, and there was kind of smoke billowing away, kind of very kind of sweet chocolatey smelling smoke blowing out among the streets of Walkley. But I mean, genuinely kind of wanted his help to try and get the kind of local spirits of Walkley and Sheffield behind our project of building Sangha. And we had a Padmasambhava Day festival shortly after, and those of you who might remember being there, we performed a ritual where we took cake out to the different corners of the Buddhist centre, different parts of the gardens, and offered cake to the local deities and chanted some traditional verses to just tell them that we were friendly Buddhists. We kind of wanted, we weren't any harm to them. We wanted their help. And when Satyajyoti became chair recently, some of the trustees, we went round again round the grounds and chanted some traditional verses and offered cake to the local deities. Actually, since then, things have been much more settled. I think the deities like the cake. So we can invoke a protector deity, and we can. So on Padmasambhava Day, we were invoking also Padmasambhava and asking for Padmasambhava to protect our Sangha, to kind of protect our Sangha from any obstructive spirits. And, and in the same way, we were making offerings to the local obstructive spirits. So you can, you can find Western Buddhists doing this kind of thing. But you can also, maybe you could see it as a way of connecting with our environment as well, kind of just the land around us and the energy of the land around us. And it sounds very weird because we no longer believe in spirits in places, but in traditional cultures, in our culture until very recently, we did, and places would have spirits, trees would have spirits, people who with what we'd call now mental illness we would see as being possessed by spirits. But putting all of that aside, it's possible to reframe these two verses in a way that's probably much more accessible and much more kind of helpful to all of us here at Sangha Night. So those of you familiar with the story of Padmasambhava and the building of the monastery at Samme will know that we can also see these obstructive spirits as representing obstructive parts within us, within ourselves, obstructive emotions deep within us, and we can make offerings to subdue them and even convert them, these energies deep within us. So we've all got aspects of ourselves that aren't fully behind the Dharma. All of us have, otherwise we'd be enlightened. We've all got parts of us that aren't completely and fully behind the Dharma. And we don't think of these as spirits in a sense, but in a sense, we could see them like that. It's as though one way of looking at it is that we're made up of lots of different souls. We've got lots of different drives. And sometimes these selves are in competition with each other. The drives are competing, conflicting. And our energy just gets kind of cancelled out and we're not able to be wholehearted in our Dharma life. So we're disintegrated or unintegrated. Our energy is locked up. It's not available to us for the Dharma life. And these energies aren't integrated. They're unintegrated because we're not aware of them. We're not aware of the different drives within us. They're a non-rational, kind of sub-rational level. We're just not aware of them. Even though they can be, we're kind of blind to these drives and desires within us, even though they might be really obvious to our friends and people around us, we don't see them. So you might remember we use the metaphor on the intermediate course. It's as though in our depths, there's a banqueting hall full of all these really amazing archetypal energies and qualities. So there might be a warrior energy deep within us that's fast asleep, or a king or queen energy deep within us that's fast asleep, or a wizard energy. And in the metaphor, we talk about them being fast asleep and covered in cobwebs because we're leading such a dull life that is uninteresting to these energies. But actually, the truth is worse than that. Actually, if we don't engage some of our most creative, constructive emotions, they become destructive. Actually, if we don't engage with our emotions, they can become destructive. They can undermine what we're doing. They're obstructing us because basically we're ignoring them. If we're ignoring some of our emotions, deeper emotions, they will become obstructive, destructive even. And it's as if they come out at dark at the night time, like in the story of Samye, when the men are all asleep, the workers are all asleep. That's when these energies come out, these obstructing energies. And so that we could take that symbolism and say, okay, well, when we're not mindful, when the light of awareness isn't there, when we're unmindful, that's when these energies can come out and obstruct us in the darkness of our unawareness, unmindfulness. Yeah, and it can undermine us. It can feel like all of our hard work has been undone, just in the same way as those people trying to build the monastery of Samye. Like we can spend ages trying to work on a habit or put something in place, something positive, and then, I don't know, in one kind of unmindful outburst, it feels like we've gone backwards and all of our work has been undone. And in Buddhism, and especially in Tantric Buddhism or Vajrayana Buddhism, emotions are seen as energies. And energy isn't skillful or unskillful. It might become trapped in a particular kind of unskillful form, but energy in itself is kind of neither skillful or unskillful. It's just maybe being expressed in an unskillful way. And in Tantric Buddhism, we need the whole of our being. We need every drop of energy to break through. We were talking about breaking through into Buddhahood at the weekend. So if you want to do that, we need every drop of our energy. So in the story of Padmasambhava, he doesn't destroy the obstructive forces. He travels around Tibet, subduing the demons, but then he enters into negotiations with the Nagas. And then he convinces them all to get behind the Dharma and to help. He gets all of the obstructive spirits and deities, the Nagas, to lend their help. So you get the monastery just being constructed at a kind of super fast rate. The men are building by day, and the deities and the Nagas are building by night. So our energy needs to be transmuted, it needs to be transformed. It isn't banished and it isn't destroyed. In Buddhism, we don't slay the dragon, but we harness it, we befriend it. You could even say in Tantric Buddhism, we ride on the back of the dragon. So we need to acknowledge these obstructive spirits, as it were, and make offerings to them. What might that mean? What might it mean to make offerings to the obstructive spirits within us? We need to acknowledge them to start with, and we need to kind of rouse them, wake them up by speaking their language. So you remember on the intermediate course, we talk about speaking the language of the depth, speaking in the language of dreams, myths, ritual, poetry, story, archetype. This is the way we can make offerings to these obstructive spirits and engage with them. We need to get these other sides of ourselves on side with our Dharma project, this project of living the Dharma life. We need to harness that energy, get it on side, bring it on side. We need to make offerings to these obstructive spirits within us, considering what it is they really want and need, and trying to give it to them in a skillful way. So sometimes really important bits of us, really important energy, just get inadvertently left out of the Dharma life. Just kind of accidentally we leave really important bits of us or energies out of our Dharma life. And it can sometimes be that some of the activities that don't seem necessarily related to Dharma or Dharma activity, they're the activities that really energize us and get our energy available to us and energized and our energy flowing. And then it can become available for the Dharma life. So until the Dharma kind of directly touches those bits of us in our depths, we need to engage with the activities that bring us alive, that energize us, get our energy available to us. So for me, it's football, unfortunately, kind of engaging with watching football. I don't really play football anymore, but I used to. It just seems to energise me in a particular way. I can remember a time when I was just really diligently trying to be an order member, a good order member, and kind of do the things that good order members do, but I wasn't really enjoying it, and I was struggling in a way. I didn't have a lot of energy. And I remember meeting with a Moga Vangsin and saying to me, well, you've been a good Buddhist, why don't you go and watch a football match, go and take your dad and watch a football match. And it's something I hadn't done for years. In a way, I'd kind of abandoned it. Football had been a big part of my life, but I just thought, well, it's not really anything related to the Dharma. My life is, I want my life to be about the Dharma, so I don't need this in my life anymore. But as soon as I went back to Anfield and watched Liverpool play, and it was a season where we nearly won the league, we had Luis Suarez playing up front, for those of you who remember, and we came very close to winning the league, and suddenly I just became full of energy and full of life and full of joy and happiness, and that became available to my Dharma life. Like I was much more full of life in my Dharma activities. It seemed that there's an activity that wasn't really connected to the Dharma. I'd kind of inadvertently left out of my life and left loads of energy behind as well. So friends of mine have got other activities that work for them. So Aryadasa recently, it's been hockey. Playing hockey has been really important to rediscover energy for him. And I've got friends who are into train spotting, which is really important to them, or trains and steam engines and sailing, yachting. So whatever it is, it might, for each of us, it's going to be unique to us. What is the activity that energizes you, and make sure you don't inadvertently leave it out of your life. And it also seems that having fun and humor and play are really important to get those obstructive energies and spirits actually interested in the Dharma. If the Dharma life suddenly becomes playful and full of fun and enjoyment, well, they're not going to obstruct it anymore. They're going to be happy to let us get on with it. So it's important that we have humor and play and fun in our Dharma life. Okay, so some of the energies that seem to be obstructive to us and also seem to maybe be the most repulsive to us, that we're most repelled by, they're going to end up becoming extremely valuable to us in our Dharma life. They might end up becoming Dharma protectors even. So we've already heard how in the story of Padmasambhava and the demons, the Nagas end up becoming protectors and building the monastery. And in other Buddhist traditions, up in there, that's the Nagas. the technological spirit's obstructing me. We're quite happy to say that technology is alive, don't we? When our car breaks down or the internet stops working, it's against us, isn't it? There's like a malevolent spirit behind it. So we're maybe not quite so rational as we think we are. And in other Buddhist traditions, the Nagas are also seen as being protectors. So in the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, it said that a great Naga king, a Naga serpent, wrapped itself around the Buddha whilst he was meditating 7 times, wrapped his huge body around the body of the Buddha to insulate the Buddha and protect the Buddha from a storm. So the Nagas can be protectors of the Dharma. And in the perfection of wisdom tradition, the Nagas are said to have protected the perfection of wisdom sutras, including the Heart Sutra, until a time when humans were ready to receive them and practice them. So the Nagas can be both obstructive and protectors. Yeah, and traditionally, Dharma protectors are gnarly, kind of rather obstructive forces, beings, but then they're beings that have been converted to the Dharma. So they initially start out as being obstructive to the Dharma, but then converted. And then they use their kind of gnarly, not so nice energies to protect the Dharma, protect the Buddha and the Sangha. And the original Dharma protector from very, very, very early Buddhism was a figure called Vajrapani. I'm going to skip forward. Hopefully this is an image of Vajrapani. This is a wrathful form of Vajrapani. And he first appears in the Pali Canon in sutras where he's a yaksha, a kind of local spirit, but a kind of an aggressive, kind of unhelpful, angry kind of spirit. And the Buddha converts him. He's impressed by the Buddha. The Buddha teaches him. And he converts to the Dharma. And then he crops up again on occasions when the Buddha needs him in suttas and stories. Sometimes when the Buddha's being challenged or threatened or someone's trying to undermine the Buddha, Vajrapani will appear above the Buddha's head, holding a vajra, waving it threateningly above the Buddha's head. And the person who's trying to undermine the Buddha will kind of back down. And Vajrapani was a very imposing presence, an intimidating presence. And the Buddha, in a way, this tries to invoke the presence of the Buddha. We sometimes have the sense of like a Buddhist is somebody who's very passive and a bit of a doormat and very kind of friendly and nice. But actually the Buddha was a very formidable presence, a very imposing presence, an awesome presence. You wouldn't mess with the Buddha. So the Buddha had this kind of, Vajra energy, which was symbolized by Vajrapani, the Dharma protector, who would appear above the head of the Buddha and wave a Vajra. So we've all got these kind of forces within us. We've got aggression, anger, competitiveness, lust. And a lot of our energy gets tied up in these drives, almost like kind of animalistic, sub-rational drives. But we need to get that energy on the side of the Dharma practice, on the side of the Dharma to become Dharma protector energy. We can harness that energy. And we need to make offerings to the protectors, to this protector energy. And again, we need to do that using symbolic, archetypal language that it understands, that this energy will understand and respond to. So the symbol of the Vajra is a really important symbol, and it's a way of kind of invoking this Dharma protector energy for ourselves, and you can see it as a way of making offerings to the Dharma protectors. So initially we can invoke, when we're in these situations of adversity, when we're trying to practice, trying to train our mind, and it's really challenging, we can invoke some of this energy, some of this Dharma protector energy in situations when we need it. And this can give us the courage to experience and express emotions in this kind of more Vajra way, this more kind of courageous way. And it can feel like we're kind of channeling this energy, this kind of Dharma protector energy from outside of us. So it's not unusual for true Ratna Buddhists to have Vajras or to wear Vajras. So a friend of mine I saw was wearing, had a necklace with a Vajra that they were wearing this afternoon. I brought my own personal Vajra from home just to give me some courage and Vajric energy during this talk. It's not unusual for Buddhists to have a Vajra and to have it as a symbol, to have this energy to help them to break through, to channel some of this aggressive, angry energy and use it in service of the Dharma, actually. So the symbol of the Vajra. The other thing we can do, another thing we can do to engage with the Dharma protectors is mantra. You could chant the mantra of Padmasambhava, Dharma protector, in a difficult situation, a situation of adversity. If you feel like you need some of this strength, some of this power of a Dharma protector, you could chant the mantra of Padmasambhava or the mantra of Vajrapani. We chant the Vajrapani, we chant both of these mantras actually at the end of the puja, the Vajrapani mantra and the Padmasambhava mantra. Yeah, so we can chant a mantra or wear a Vajra or hold a Vajra or just bring to mind these Dharma protector symbols in a situation of adversity, a difficult situation. And suddenly it can feel like we've got far greater resources to call upon. We've suddenly got much more strength than we usually have, much more courage than we usually have to draw upon. So we need to make offerings to our Dharma protectors to invoke them. If we want to have the strength and energy to actually be effective in the world, to make change and to really live our Dharma life. So, how am I doing for time? Just a very quick example for me was my own anger and aggression, which was completely blocked, as was kind of most of my emotion when I came involved with Buddhism. I kind of just my emotion wasn't available to me, and I didn't really feel things strongly. I didn't really know what I thought or felt about things, and I just knew that I wouldn't say what I thought or felt because it might upset people. So I'd really kind of also just squash down and repress my values, what was most important to me, because I didn't want to speak out really. And this worked fine for most of my life, actually, until I wanted to live a Dharma life, and then suddenly that wasn't working anymore. And what started to happen through meditation, I just became aware of anger and energy that I'd just been blocked and sitting on. And there's a long story. I've told this story in longer versions in other talks, so you can listen in more detail to how I worked with this energy, but just summarising. Yeah, basically, there came a time after I was ordained, I started to invoke the energy of Padmasambhava, doing the Padmasambhava practice, visualization practice. Suddenly, actually also at the time of my ordination, I became aware of a real kind of rage, almost like an uncontrollable rage, and it was very, very frightening. And the advice I was given by spiritual friends at the time was actually this was a really positive energy, but it was just kind of expressing itself in this way. And I needed this energy in my Dharma life. What needed to happen is I needed to find a way of transforming it into Dharma protector energy. I needed to start to own my own opinions and speak out to protect what I valued. It wasn't enough anymore just to kind of not speak out, not say what I thought. I needed to really speak the truth in situations and protect, stand up for what I believed in. So I needed to harness this kind of energy and express it in a completely different way. Yeah, that's a kind of short version of the story. You can listen to a much longer version of the story in some other talks that I've given about this. Yeah, basically, what I needed to do, what I'll conclude by saying is we need all four of these practices, all four of these special practices. I'll just show you, before I talk about that, I forgot to show you a nice picture of Vajrapani from Padmaloka, which I really like, and a picture of a Vajra, in case you couldn't see the Vajra before. But basically, we need to be working with these four practices all the time. So, you know, if you are going to engage with strong emotion, and you know, if you keep practicing the Dharma life, at some point you will kind of engage strong emotion, whether you like it or not. You will experience strong emotion. You need to be practicing in these four ways. You need to really be cultivating skillful momentum, skillful karma, positive momentum, loads of merit. Yeah, we need to cultivate channels, in a way, positive channels through the positive precepts, new beautiful positive emotions, new channels for our emotions to flow down, for it to be expressed in. We need to build lots of momentum behind these new positive habits. And there's an image I shared with my group at the weekend. It's my friend Atra shared an image with me, a metaphor. Well, if you want to get rid of negative habits, we need to, he said, you need to plant beautiful flowers, rose bushes, to hide out the weeds so the weeds don't get any sun. So if we put all our energy into cultivating positive karma, positive momentum, in a way, that's a big part of it. The negative habits will start to lose energy. They'll be kind of weakened. And then alongside that confession is like pulling those weeds out continuously. Keep pulling out those negative habits. Keep doing the weeding, pulling out those negative habits. Keep getting the roots out and showing them the light of day so that they wither and they die, those negative habits die. So we need to be working in this kind of rational, karmic way all the time. And at the same time, that's not enough because most of our energy is subterranean. Most of our emotions are below the level of our awareness. So we need to be working in a non-rational way as well, a mythic way. We need to engage these obstructive energies and spirits and make offerings to them by relating to them in the language that they speak. And we need to be invoking the Dharma protectors and making offerings to them as well. Yeah, so we need to be thinking, what kind of skillful, neutral activities get your energies engaged and flowing again? And we need to use cunning and negotiate sometimes with different parts of us to get them behind the Dharma life, to persuade them that actually the Dharma is a good thing. There'd be bits of us that might be frightened and put off by the Dharma, but we can get to know them, we can befriend different parts of ourselves over a period of time in meditation, outside of meditation. And find out what values drive these different bits of you. What actually drives them? What are their needs? What are their rose bushes that are being kind of trampled on by your Dharma life? What will get these different parts of you to help to be behind the Dharma? Yeah, and then we need to make offerings to the Dharma protectors too. We need to invoke this Vajra energy of the Dharma protectors of Vajrapani and Padmasambhava, the power of the Vajra through symbol, through mantra, through puja. And to use that to break through our old habits and to draw on courage and strength, bravery in difficult situations. And eventually, it's like, yeah, we can find new jobs, new employment for our obstructive spirits. So with Padmasambhava, he got the Nagas and the obstructive deities. He gave them new jobs. They were building the Dharma, the monastery. And in our Dharma life, we need to find different jobs for those obstructive spirits. And for me, in my anger, actually, it became using that energy, channeling that energy just to say no to things that were not conducive to the Dharma, to stand up for them and to speak out against them. And to have the courage and the bravery to, well, sometimes just to say the truth to people, even if they don't like it. I've become much, much more used to now. Like before, I would never do that. I would never speak the truth to people, just if I thought they might get upset. Whereas now it's just become very, very straightforward. I just say what needs to be said most of the time. I sometimes get a little bit scared, but most of the time it's just very, very clean and straightforward. I just say, well, this is the truth. So we can find new jobs for our repressed energy, so they'll be no longer obstructing us, no longer we'll no longer need to ignore them. We can engage them and give them new jobs. So by using all four of these special practices or these superhero powers, we can perform magic, we can perform alchemy, and really transmute these emotions from being something very destructive to our Dharma life to being something very constructive and protective, something really wonderful and awesome. And we can end up cultivating the hearts and minds of a Bodhisattva in this way, and that is a real superhero.